Welcome to the Christadelphian Classics podcast, brought to you by Wilderness Voice. Principles and Proverbs by Islip Collier. Part 1, Principles. Chapter 13, Application of Principles. A series of articles running through a magazine necessarily lacks the final revision, excision, and rearrangement that is possible in the preparation of a book. We cannot know beforehand how far thoughts will extend or when the editor may call a halt. The series, however, has one advantage in that criticisms and comments come to hand while the work is in progress instead of all arriving after the book is complete. It may be possible, therefore, to correct some misapprehensions and to meet or try to meet some objections. The most disappointing messages have been some rather ill-tempered comments assuming that these articles are designed solely as a contribution to the current controversy. Some critics seem to take it for granted that any writer will try to make his principles dance in attendance on his practice instead of trying to make practice conform to principle. Well, human nature, even with divine light to guide it, is truly bad enough, but surely we're not also completely ruled by the flesh. It simply would not be worth the trouble of writing if friendly readers were merely on the lookout for hits at opponents and unfriendly readers only interested in the problem of hitting back. At the beginning of this series, it was suggested that the fair enunciation of Bible principles might deal blows with impartial severity at reader and writer. There has certainly been no conscious deviation by a hair's breadth through the recollection of principles that have been violated by self or friends. And there has been far more feeling of concern for the application of principles in the future than the failure to apply them in the past. In varying measure and in different directions, we've all been guilty. The past is dead and irrevocable, but the present is living and plastic. If, therefore, we can assist ourselves and each other to pilot scriptural principles through the latent mazes of the complex human heart, a better course may be shaped now, even if the heart proves too deceitful for anyone to make a frank confession of past errors. It's a mistake to regard this series as an outcome of recent controversy. It's rather an effort to present a sketch of a larger idea that's been in mind for many years. More than 10 years ago, an exhortation to all parts was written and published. The writer was convinced then that the gravest danger to the brotherhood was in the tendency for men of different temperaments to get into opposing grooves and criticize each other, the worst fault on both sides being just in such ill-tempered criticism. This is assuredly almost a quotation from the article of 10 years ago. It was perceived as a law of human nature that extremes beget extremes and that in the time of strife, men always lose their sense of proportion, almost always misrepresent, and very often become so unfair as to bar and bolt the door to peace. It was recognized that there were literally hundreds of possible differences of judgment, any one of which, if thrown into the arena of fleshly controversy, might be magnified so as to cause strife, division, and the cessation of constructive work. The conviction was formed that in a brotherhood of frail mortals with no visible head, and in an age of almost universal self-confidence and self-expression, there was vital need for a broad and comprehensive knowledge of principles. We must know human nature as well as being acquainted with the commands of God. Above all, the conviction was formed that a clear perception of abstract truth was the essential prelude to sound and fair judgment of concrete matters. He who knows men may be able to understand a man. One who is acquainted with the abstract possibilities of self-deception may be able to recognize the signs of prejudice and deceitful reasoning even in himself. The more clearly we have in mind those great principles taught in the Word of God, the better chance there will be that we can take a comprehensive view when one phase of the truth is predominant and there is gross exaggeration in the strife of tongues. This touches another matter which might be described as a principle. Men persistently exaggerate with the idea that they help their cause. They may be right, considering it simply as a human cause. A man may command attention by exaggerating when no one would notice a plain statement of truth. But if our desire is to do right in the sight of God and to make righteous judgment in the work committed to us, exaggeration is utterly evil. If one has committed a fault, an exaggeration of his offence tends to cover it and prevent reparation. Any inclination towards contrition is at once dried up by the unfair charges. Accusations which everyone might have seen to be true are completely lost in a torrent of accusations that almost everyone knows to be false. This is the way of the devil's party warfare. Men divide into opposing camps, trying to think the worst of each other and so intent on the war of words that they lose sight of principles altogether. The time past ought to have served brethren for such strife. It belongs to the world, and we ought to avoid such methods as we would avoid the plague. There has been some comment on the matter of judging. It's been suggested that some brethren, quote, judge not in trying to shirk a duty. Reference has been made to the manner in which idolatry was put down in ancient Israel and the responsibility of all to take their share in righteous judgment. Well, surely no one has denied that we have to judge righteous judgment. If Christ had meant to forbid any such effort on our part, he surely would have said, judge not at all, instead of putting the matter as he did. Perhaps there are some brethren who have fallen into the error of supposing that the Lord forbade the use of judgment altogether in dealing with the fellow man. It is to be feared, however, that many more have fallen into the opposite and more serious error. Perceiving that Christ's words could not be understood in the absolute sense, they've ignored them altogether and even object to their being quoted. There is vital need at the present time for repeated emphasis of these words, not merely for the rebuke of a few, but for the benefit of all. We need to understand the words and remember them. Christ did not say, judge not at all. He said, judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye mete, it shall be measured to you again. It's another way of saying that God will have judgment without mercy on those who show no mercy. It applies to all matters of judgment, and it surely touches the spirit in which judgment is made as much as the act itself. When Christ delivered the faulty woman from her accusers, he did not justify her action. He did not oppose the judgment that she'd sinned, or that, according to the law of God, stoning was the penalty. In a properly regulated state, it would be good for the people of God to have such sins put down in such a drastic manner. But then, if the state had been properly regulated and the law of God honoured, the woman probably would have never have committed the offence. The intolerable thing was that, in a time of general faultiness and with no effective lead for the people of God, there should be a sudden excess of zeal for slaying just one among many equally guilty. Christ met the situation in his inimitable way. He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. None condemned the woman then, and the Lord, who was without sin, and who alone among the sons of men might dare to face judgment without mercy, did not condemn her either. A perfectly clear principle emerges from this precept and example regarding judgment, and assuredly it's a principle which needs to be emphasized continually for the benefit of all. Our tendency is to be so blind to our own faults and so acutely conscious of faults in others. There's such a danger of being partial in judgment. In other words, allowing the deceitful human heart to influence the intellect. There are times when our understanding of Scripture calls upon us to judge and perhaps repudiate the words and actions of our fellows. At such times especially must we remember the precept and example of Christ. The illustrations of drastic action in ancient Israel are rather difficult to apply in these days when the circumstances are so different, and from the days of the old Puritans until now, very faulty arguments have been developed on these lines. Surely the brethren must know that we're not living under the Mosaic dispensation. It was stated by Moses that all who refused to hear the great prophet should be cut off. Christ was the prophet promised. But when two of the disciples wanted to call for summary judgment on those who refused to receive him, he reproved them. You know not what manner of spirit ye are of, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. Even in the days of drastic and summary punishment, the approved leaders of Israel were willing to accept explanations of matters they judged to be wrong. When the altar was set up by the two tribes beyond Jordan, the rest of Israel prepared to make war on the apparent infidelity, but they gladly accepted the explanation that the altar was only intended as a witness and was in no sense to be used for worship contrary to God's law. Was the building of this altar entirely justifiable, or was it absolutely wrong and the explanation a subterfuge? Or was it an act which could not be put in either extreme category? Unwise indeed in view of Israel's weakness, but a pardonable error in view of the explanations? We might not all agree in judgment on the matter even now, with all the advantage distant lends in freeing the mind from bias and prejudice. It is possible that some in Israel thought the explanation unsatisfactory and lame. They all agreed, however, not to make war on their brethren, and assuredly they were right in that. There were other occasions of more serious departure from rectitude when the summary justice was meted out. Puritans and others have often quoted the drastic judgment of men who despised God's law to justify their violence toward men who repudiated their opinions. Do not let us fall into such miserable error. In these milder days of saving men's lives, it cannot be right to count brethren as enemies to be hated because they differ from us in the judgment of matters which are not defined in Scripture. Some who quote the severe provisions of the Mosaic law may suggest that just as Israel was required to be united in condemning a departure to serve other gods, so we must be united in resisting the preaching of another gospel. Surely we can all agree with this. We must, however, try to judge righteous judgment and preserve a sense of proportion in the use of words. There are many brethren who are doing and saying that which is wrong and unjust, but they're not repudiating the gospel. Neither are they bringing upon themselves the curse of God by preaching another gospel. The danger is that not all Christadelphians will preach another gospel other than that they have received. The danger is rather that the vital duty of preaching will be neglected and hindered through the waste of money, time, and energy in an unprofitable strife. We shall be judged at last by the word that Christ has spoken, not by the partial and prejudiced words of erring man. I know of no picture of the judgment seat showing any rejected through their toleration of weak brethren or for their toleration of those who would tolerate weak brethren. There is a terrible picture of some confident disciples being rejected through their failure to dispense the bread and water and the covering garment to those in need. Most confidently and earnestly would we urge this thought. The vast majority of people in the world are in prison, without a garment, and perishing for the lack of the bread and water of life. Where are the real differences between us to justify the hindering of this great work to which we're called? We have the life-giving treasure in faulty earthen vessels, it is true. But we have it, and we're responsible for its proper use. Why such wasteful war of words in these closing times of the Gentiles, with more naked millions of Adam's sons than ever peopled the earth, before all needing garments and some even knowing their need? Even though some readers may dislike the views expressed in these chapters, surely all must admit that a little light has been thrown on Bible principles and a little service rendered in calling attention to Bible teaching. Surely everyone must recognise that there's been a need for emphasis of the fact that we have been called by God to the fellowship of the gospel, and that this involves fellowship with the Father and the Son. On this basis, it must be conceded, in theory at least, that we must not cut any members off from our fellowship unless we have clear scriptural lead. In other words, the extreme course of withdrawal should be on a scriptural principle which can be stated and are consistently applied as a principle. It may be urged that some cases of transgression are so complex that it's impossible to make a consistent application of rules. The Bible shows that some sins should be reproved, some publicly rebuked, 1 Timothy 5 verse 20, and some should be repudiated with the extreme step of withdrawal from the offender. How can frail mortals agree as to the category in which any complex instance of faulty conduct should be placed? We're commanded not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers, 2 Corinthians 6 verse 14. Surely the only honest interpretation of this command is to recognise that it applies to all kinds of yoking, whether bond service, marriage, business partnerships, clubs, societies, trade unions or federations. We must assist each other to avoid all such entanglements as much as we can, and where there is a flagrant violation of this principle of separation and we're called upon to judge, then especially must we remember the Lord's words regarding judging. There are many different degrees of offence in this matter, and inevitably there'll be much difference in judgment. We have no scriptural authority whatever for cutting off our brethren for differing from us in judgment as to the proper application of a recognised principle. Brethren clearly transgress when they go to extremes in condemnation of one particular form of yoking with the unbeliever, while taking no notice of other forms of the same error. It may be there are some who are ready to make an effort to be consistent in these matters. They are ready to make the clean-cut line and require all in their fellowship to agree to the righteousness of its incisive judgment. All workers in doubtful positions must cut clear from the alien connection at whatever cost, in wages or pensions. All businessmen with unbelieving partners must dissolve partnership at whatever cost to their businesses. We could always respect those who really suffer loss for conscience' sake, but there would never be agreement as to just where the line should be drawn for other people. 20 points of dispute could be raised in as many minutes. The only result of such an attempt at consistency would be a protractive and destructive discussion with the inevitable hindering of essential duties and with the warping of intellect and character which always comes with a prolonged wrangle. Suppose you decide, as most brethren apparently have decided, that business partnerships are not so serious yokings as marriage or bond service to the state. It still must be remembered that the man who takes a business partner cannot plead either primitive passion or the pressure of authority by way of excuse. He wants to make money, so that even the motive is questionable. We cannot believe that anyone would claim that all cases of alien marriage must be treated with the utmost severity, while all cases of alien business partnerships must be passed as legitimate. To take a simple illustration, a brother in a wild and lawless part of the world meets a virtuous and teachable woman who has been led by a misleading offer of work into a society which is intolerable. He believes that she'll certainly obey the truth as soon as she can thoroughly examine it, and he marries her so that she can go with him to a more favourable environment. Another brother in an orderly town, far removed from all such temptations, has been earning a comfortable living, but with the hope of making a fortune, he enters into a partnership with a worldly and unscrupulous man. Which of the two is the greater offence? The question may then be raised, if each offence has to be dealt with on its own merits and human judgments differ, how can we have a consistent application of scriptural principles? The answer is that we can have it by taking note of all scriptural principles instead of exaggerating the subject of the moment and neglecting everything else. The letters to the ecclesias make it quite plain that in the application of scriptural principles, one ecclesia is not held responsible for the faults of another. The apostle lays down the rule that we must, in love, be subject to one another. This means the rule of the majority, which is the only possible rule among brethren in the absence of the master. When an offence has been committed, then the ecclesia must decide whether it calls for ecclesial action and whether action should take the form of rebuke or withdrawal. If opinions differ, then do not fly off at a tangent because you cannot have your own way. Dr. Thomas. In love, be subject one to another. When an ecclesia insists on withdrawing from an offender, if some members feel that the action is too drastic, they have the right to decline the responsibility of such action while submitting to the decision of the majority. This is the scriptural rule, and it's the only workable way. A contrary rule has been enunciated that all members must actively support a motion of withdrawal or themselves be cut off. This is a new idea, and it is as unworkable as it is unscriptural. There's no probability that the slightest attempt will be made to apply it consistently. If it were applied, the result would be small meetings with one dominating personality in each and no Christianity in any of them. On the other hand, if there is a comprehensive understanding and continued recollection of scriptural principles, each ecclesia will face its responsibilities of judging matters that pertain to this life, as the Lord requires. It will reprove and rebuke as need may arise with all long-suffering and patience. All members will be subject one to another in love. If need be, they will withdraw from an offender, but with the hope of restoring the guilty one. 1 Corinthians 5 verse 5. If one is treated too severely, he will suffer wrong, rather than embroil the whole brotherhood in a dispute, the merits of which can only be judged by the Lord himself. It is by preaching the gospel to the poor, by strengthening the feeble and comforting the weary, by holding forth the word of life, the garment for the naked, bread and water for the hungry and thirsty, the message of life for those in prison, that is the way of life for us.